The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast about board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And this is episode 462, Stonemaier Games Tier List. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. Hey friends, we're back. And as always, we're talking about the latest and the greatest in tabletop gaming. So, of course, it's about that time to talk about one of the great companies out there that are producing some of the latest and greatest games of all time. Anthony, who is that company?
We are talking about Stonemaier Games this week. They've got a big new game you may or may not have heard of. Something about dragons.
You sure? I thought it was about worms.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. I keep getting it mixed up. I think worm. They can't have made a game about worms. It must be about dragons. No, it's about worms.
At some point, someone's going to do that as a parody game, right? They have to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The worms, it'd just be like worms with wings that are flapping around.
Hey, they had a video game back in the day, you know, so it was cute. Worms, you know, stuff like that.
I would love, like, a worms board. I mean, I know that there was one, I think, actually.
There was a Kickstarter one with a lot of plastic a couple years back, and it was not that great, I guess, because it came out and I have not seen anything about it, but it was a thing. It was a thing.
But give me Elizabeth Hargrave.
Oh.
Take on work. I don't know. I don't even know if I'd care.
I mean, she's doing fungi. Why not worms?
Yeah.
I mean, worms are awesome. I guess. I mean, Dune has worms.
That's her thing, right? We've got birds, butterflies, and mushrooms. Uh-huh. So, what else is there?
Worms. It's a crossover. It's take Dune Imperium and Elizabeth Hargraves. They come together, and it's a game about worms and flounders. But that's a spoiler. So, there's flounders too. I won't get into it. Read the books, kids. It's complicated and weird.
Yeah, but mostly weird.
Yeah, very weird. Exceptionally weird. But enjoy the movies, because the movies are going to be awesome.
Yeah.
But yes, we are talking about Stonemaier Games. Been around for quite some time in the modern age of tabletop gaming. So many interesting, different, dynamic games. And we are going to subject that to a tier list, because that's what we do on a podcast.
Let's rank stuff. So yeah, Stonemaier Games is released, I'm pretty sure, 15 games. It's hard to tell because a lot of games get re-released or get essential editions or re-released. I don't know. So 15 games, not including Worm Spam because it's not really out yet and neither one of us has played it. But all the ones that have come out before that, up through Apiary, we're going to rank them in our tier list, which for us is our buy ratings. So we've got Burn, Dodge, Play, Buy, and then Must Buy.
Because you gotta have an S.
You got to have an S tier, right?
Okay.
You can't end it by.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, I was recently at the Level Up convention in New Jersey, and I did see at least two tables play Wormspan. So there were some people there. I did see it. I did get to the table. People seemed to enjoy it. And I saw some Apiary being played. I think that was the game I saw at the most number of tables. So ergo, Stonemaier Games, Jamie Stegmaier, welcome back. Let's crunch some games. But before we get into that, Anthony, let's get into what all our listeners are talking about. What's our question of the week?
All right. Question of the week this week, probably because someone was at a convention.
Who? Me?
Without me. that's just kidding. I was sick again.
Do you want to review or rate the sickness? Is that a, what do you think?
It wasn't too bad, honestly. It was just a cold this time. So.
Oh, okay. Well, you got through the other one, so yeah.
Yeah. They're getting progressively better. So for the people who aren't sick all the time, who get out of the house, we asked, what do you do in support of tabletop gaming? Organize, design, publish, media, events, DM, teach games. Everybody's out there doing something. We wanted to know what y'all are doing. And Game Master Dave, our good friend and a recent backer on Patreon, posted, for tabletop gaming, I organize events and conventions. I've dabbled with game design. I teach games at libraries, game stores, conventions, and local events. I stream games and post videos on YouTube. I review events and games on my website. I dabble with podcasting and short video series. Dave gets around.
He does a thing or two or 20, to say the least.
Yeah. Dave is amazing. So much great stuff.
Absolutely.
Tom says, I do organize a monthly heavy game day at a local brewery. Otherwise, I just play and spend my money on game-related stuff.
So,
hey, if you organize a game day, you're doing the Lord's work, because it's so hard to get people together.
It's amazingly hard. I do it. I mean, you do it on Meetup, or you do it on Facebook or Board Game Geek. Herding kittens. I mean, that's... I legitimately, and I hate to, I don't want to say this out loud because I think someone's going to steal the idea, but so I'm going to say trademark because like that'll make it sure it's legal and stuff. But I think I've thought for so many years there should be a board game about trying to get other board game people to play board games, because it's like the ultimate logistical nightmare at the table. Because how are we doing this? How is it happening? So if you're doing it and you're out there and you're organizing any number of people, friends, family, especially strangers, you're doing amazing work for the tabletop industry, and especially for the friendly local game stores out there who certainly could use the support, because running a store and organizing groups, really way too much to do.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's, I don't know that I've ever actually organized a game group. I've had game days at my house, but usually like people who are already in a group with. So all the kudos in the world to the people out there who do it. So Ryan on the Patreon, he says, I haven't done anything big publicly for board games, but in a smaller scope, I'm the researcher and teacher of games of my small group.
Oh.
I'm also working on getting a few other friends and coworkers into games who have shown interest. So that's like the second best thing you can do. If you're the game rules learner.
Oh, yeah.
You can't have a game day without that. That's me. I do that.
Like, yeah.
When I am in a group, I'm the one who's like, all right, I'll learn the rules.
Yeah.
Somebody else watch a video, please. I'll learn the rules.
I organize the group. I'm the organizer, and Anthony's the game teacher. So I love that fact, because he takes a bullet for the team, because I'm like, and here's a gigantic rule book. I will herd kittens for the next 20 minutes, and you let us know when you're ready to play.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, that's rough, especially when the biggest problem in tabletop gaming is 9 times out of 10, the rule book.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, it's still a thing these days. Although, I wonder now, with AI, is that going to get better or worse? Because you know that's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Or it's already happened.
I mean, if you ask an AI to tell you the rules to a game now, you get some weird, hallucinated nonsense. But
yeah, but that's true for most rule books anyway.
That's true. Is it better or worse than a Portal Games rule book? I don't know.
Oh, my God. That's true. Explain Voidfall. No. AI's like, nope, not doing it.
ChatGPT is like, no, Sorry, no, it's my off day. Taking a break. Oh man. So Dave, over on the Patreon says, we're all supporting independent gaming media by supporting BGA on Patreon.
Woo! Yeah, Dave. Thanks, Dave.
My favorite answer. A few more answers over from the Facebook page. We have Brant, who, Chris, you just saw at the convention a few days ago.
Hey, Brant! It's me, Chris. I saw you there. You're awesome, man.
So Brant organizes, teaches, reviews, recently started doing a lot of playtesting and developing. David said he runs a Facebook group, so one that revolves around board gaming. Absolutely. David Bryson, other David, says, I love to teach games. I work in organizational learning and development, so teaching games in my spare time feels like an extension of that.
Fancy.
Eleanor says they are an editor and proofreader.
Oh,
yeah, that's, we all need more of that.
That's the real hero.
Yes. And then John says, is purchasing a choice?
It certainly is.
To which we said, yes. Yes, it is.
100%.
So thank you, everybody out there, everybody who's involved in the community, in the hobby. None of it works if we're not all out there doing something. So awesome.
Yeah. And it's like I just mentioned, I was at the Level Up convention in New Jersey, and I met so many great people, so many great gamers out there. I don't like to mention names unless I tell people I'm going to mention names. But obviously, Bob was an amazing game teacher and organizer. So thank you so much, Bob. Thank you, Sharon, for playing games, bringing me along for a great adventure. So many other people I got to play with. I'll talk about some of the games soon. And like played Flamecraft, really great people there taught me that game. So a lot of games that I've, you know, circled around a little bit. The great people at all these conventions, the great gamers. And again, we think about all the great games, but really it's about the people around the table and, you know, the insane fun we have at the table together. So again, thank you all, teachers, organizers, rule book editors, and, you know, especially the bigger organizers who do conventions and stuff like that. I think it's essential for the hobby to bring us all together, because I got to meet people I would never get to meet otherwise. And again, a lot of people out there who listen to the podcast, a lot of you came over, and it was really a nice experience for us. And yeah, great time. All right, Anthony, that's everything that's happening with our listeners out there. Let's get on to the games that we want to hit the table. Let's talk about our acquisition disorders.
All right. There's a new Vitalis Erta game that has what? Been...
Where?
More,
who?
More monies! So this is what I'm on a Discord channel where he does a lot of playtesting. So I know of this game. I've seen it. I've watched some like preview plays of it, but I had not seen the artwork for it. Nor did I realize that it was getting close to Kickstarter ready, which of course it is, because Lacerda runs a new Kickstarter campaign about every 9 months. Speakeasy is ready. Guy. Yeah. It's going up. Machine. So it's another Vitalis Lacerda with artwork by Ian O'Toole, published by Eagle Griffin Games. You all know the drill. It'll come in a big, long box that hangs off the edge of your Kalex by just like an inch. It will be on Kickstarter, and it will be about $140. So
wow,
we know all of this just from past campaigns. None of that's official, but, you know, sure it is. So the game itself is about... running a speakeasy in 1920s U.S., you know, during Prohibition. There's been a few games about Prohibition. There's Bootleggers, famously, about, like, literally, like, moving those little barrels around in your little trucks. And so this one's going to be a worker placement and card management game. So you are a mobster. You are managing your own speakeasy. And you will need to move stuff around and... increase your operation, become more infamous, upgrade your stuff. It's a Lacerda. You know you're going to be doing like 14 different things, and it's all going to weave together. And it looks good, as they often do. And the reason I'm more excited about this game than the last two is it looks more thematic, right? The reason I love Vital Lacerda games is that he takes the theme and he really fully integrates them with the mechanics in a way where it becomes, no matter how complex the game is, it becomes intuitive as you're playing it, what you should be doing. That's one of the things I struggled with Weather Machine and trying to learn that game, is that it's not very intuitive because it's a sci-fi fantasy setting. And Inventions just looked kind of abstract. Like, it wasn't really clear what you were doing. It wasn't like a specific thing. It was kind of an abstracted idea of like inventing things. This is, there's a location. You are running that location. Do it well, right? And so I like that. I really want to see Ian O'Toole's take on 1920s gangster type stuff. That'll be fun. And just in general, like, it looks like the kind of game from him that I generally enjoy. So I will probably, you know, delve a little bit deeper on this. I did not back the last one, but this one I'm like pretty tempted to. But obviously I want to see a little bit more of it.
Sure.
Get a chance to, if not poke around with it on Tabletop Simulator, at least, you know, watch a couple videos when the page goes up. But it's likely that I'll back it at this point.
Oh, that's good. He's making a comeback in your
collection. For me. Yeah.
No, I was excited to see this as well. And anytime Ian O'Toole's involved with, I think it's a really great combination and always do great games. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Again, it's a good thing to be excited. The last two games probably didn't really wow us a little bit. So, and he's got a number of other Kickstarters on the way too. So this is not the last that we'll hear from Vitella Cerda. He'll be back.
Yeah, he's a busy dude.
And yeah. All right. Well, another famous designer who's always producing game after game after game is Stefan Feld. His City Collection is back on Kickstarter from Queen Games. This is Nessa and Kathmandu. I didn't know he was still doing these because I think the last one or two that came out, Vienna, I think the Vienna one came out, and people were not happy because the production was slimmed down. I think the price was either the same or higher, and they weren't offering the same special backings like they were in the original set with Hamburg, Amsterdam, New York, and Marrakesh. I think like you could get a Feld card signature, but now it's like printed on there. It's not him actually signing the cards. And there are other little things as well. So two more games from, you know, into the City Collection. So which will bring it up to 8 games. I know that there is an extensive list. I just didn't know he was still doing the list because people were upset because the games were kind of expensive. And yeah, it's Queen Games. So first up is Nessa. It's Pirates. Feld's doing Pirates, man. So
yeah.
It's got a kind of cartoony look to it. And again, it's got a Queen's production. The production looks decent. It's similar box size as the other one before. But again, you are sailing around. You got resources. And you're able to upgrade your ship with special abilities so that you can do other stuff like fight or deal with ocean challenges. And okay. All right. Islands and pirates. So yeah. And then you get all the special bonus upgrades. Again, not as much as the first one, but it seems to be somewhat decent. At least it seems to be a little bit more of a Feld than we had seen from the other City ones in the past. And then we have Kathmandu. So again, this is the 2-set collection. So if you want to buy one, you can buy one. You want to buy two, you can. Or you could buy the full upgrade with all the different pieces here. This is a completely different way that I haven't seen Feld do before. It seems like not necessarily polyominoes, but you are building up the map. It kind of gives me vibes, not necessarily of Feast for Odin, but it is that kind of getting resources, being able to build up your camp and also explore. So a lot of goods that are going to come into play, a lot of temples that are going to be able to be, you know, chased down and searched. So it's 2 more Feld games. We have not played or previewed or, you know, got a chance to get these out or get these to the table or see these at a convention. But if you do want to pick these two games up at their fanciest, it's $245.
So stupid.
They're claiming that their MSRP will be $398. Again, You could buy these individually. If you do want to buy all of them, and I mean all of the City Collection, so you're looking at 9 games plus coins, it's $1,000. It's $999. So.
Oh, my God.
So, get your pennies together, Anthony.
No, I refuse. This is dumb. I cannot with this anymore. Like, you can't just say something's MSRP because that's a number you throw out. And it's not even in the store.
Yeah.
And the reason it's not in the store is because no store would sell it. They're not going to buy this at wholesale and then put it on their shelf for 4 years.
Sure.
It's dumb. Like, and it's, I can concur that they do, in fact, try to sell these games for these prices at the conventions. I saw a copy of Marrakesh at their booth for $225.
Yeah.
It's dumb, though. And Queen Games is not exactly, like, we just talked about the next Vital Lacerda game. That's a game with an MSRP that I could see it being $140. Like, the production level is very high. These are not that. They're not even close to that. Even, like, the super fancy version of Marrakesh that you have that we played last year. Yeah. It's good, but it's not on that level.
No.
Why is it $225? That's this is so stupid. Telling me it's $130 for like a normal Queen box.
Yeah.
Like you get the classic version, they're like MSRP is $130. I'm like, for a game, just a game that in the past you would sell on Amazon for $25. Really? What are you doing?
It's really hard because you and I have been huge Feld fans. You've owned every Feld. I've owned close to every Feld. We promoted, loved, and just still do so many of the Feld games out there. So it is hard to see this. I mean, I understand inflation and things have gone up, but as you mentioned, just the base game, none of the fancy extras, the MSRP is $130. So when this gets out into the market, I guess, obviously, depending where they sell it, it's going to be $130 for a base Feld that, again, no one's necessarily played. It's not in retail is what I'm saying. So it's not like people are playing it and then someone decides to pay $130 for a game, as you mentioned, like what Queen Games were throwing away their games. But even if it wasn't that, even if it was $60, gotcha, or $70, I don't know, but $130 for just the standard base kind of production is really outside. I think it's outside the mainstream, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And then the deluxe version is the MSRP is $200. And again, there are upgrade pieces. There are acrylic pieces in here. And again, I don't know the production and the cost and things like that, but in no way, shape, and form is, you know, additional pieces to this game, you know, justify a $200 price tag. $200 for another, I'm sure it's going to be a fine Feld game, but again, it's just, it's really kind of heartbreaking because, like I said, I talked about this before. I bought all four the initial run and it was really way too expensive and the games are not as great as his other previous games. Marrakesh is probably the best. The other three re-implementations of his other games, which I was really hopeful for because I love his game so much and they're not as good. Again, that's my feeling, my take on it. Not bad, but $200 for, $200, Anthony, $200 for a couple of upgraded pieces. I mean, I don't know how they don't look at this and just wonder. I don't know how they look at this.
It's obscene. Yeah. And like, I don't know. Obviously enough people are paying that money. They have almost 1,000 backers. They're up to $250,000. But there's no way it wouldn't be higher if they stopped increasing the price. And it's gone up every campaign. Every campaign, they're like, now MSRP is this much. You're like, why? What? Nothing changed. What are you doing?
Sure.
Economies of scale. I'm like, well, you could scale higher if you stopped gouging people. You could make more copies of the game. So, I don't know. These campaigns, the City Collection, is literally the reason why I stopped collecting stuff on Feld games. I've now sold a lot of them that I don't play as much.
Sure.
Because I was like, well, I'm never getting these, so I don't need to be a completionist, so I can get rid of the ones I don't like as much. It's a shame. I love me some Feld. Kathmandu looks like an interesting game that I'd probably like. Nassau looks very forgettable. It doesn't mean it's bad, it just doesn't look great. But I will probably never play these because I'm not paying that kind of money for you know, unless I find out it's like the second coming of the Castle of Burgundy, I'm not paying that much money for these games.
It's, I don't know. I don't, we've talked about this. It kind of breaks my heart because it just, I want to play these games. They're just, and again, if you can afford them, by all means. But the production here and the artwork here is not at the level of a $200 game right off the bat. I'm sorry. Like, I do want a journey in Nepal, and I do want to, you know, explore. And I love the idea that he's exploring all different, you know, cities around the world. But I just even look at the production. Well, look, it's on Kickstarter. Take a look at it for yourself. It ends its run on Thursday, February 29th. It's already surpassed its ridiculous $25,000 goal, as you said. Yeah, that's the thing. Also on this, I just want to mention a couple of other ones pretty quick. So I think it's just came out today. There's been an announcement that Kemet, Blood and Sand, the also another Kickstarter, immense, beautiful Kickstarter, a lot of plastic, but again, worthy of its price tag and all of its minis. They're going to have another, they're going to have an expansion coming out for it. It's going to include a solo and six player mode.
No.
There you go, Anthony. Add more people to the table.
Yeah. This might be one of the rare games where that works, because you want more people banging into each other.
And I think when they're, since they said six player mode, right, another god joins the battle, I think since it's not just six players, I think six player mode, I'm assuming this means teams.
Probably.
I'm assuming they're going to do like an Ankh thing where it's like you team up with somebody else. So maybe six is actually just, you know, three teams of two. So solo's good. Solo's always good because it'd be nice to get this to the table when you can't find five or six people. And again, Kemet is all about trips on a map and really pressing the battles. So more the merrier as far as that's concerned. And there's also new modules, which they do not say any more about other than there's new modules. And they show a picture of a mini. So minis, gigantic minis. So that will also be coming out. And again, I love the fact, Anthony, that they came out with the base game.
Yes.
And I got to play the base game. Love the base game. Not to say it wasn't expensive, and not to say it didn't come with other stuff, because it did. It had its own little mini, you know, Cthulhu expansion and such. Mm-hmm. But now I can purchase the expansion if I want to, because I played the base game. I feel more confident.
Yes.
So please split up your stuff. Let us play the base game. Let us get it like 5 minutes with the base game before. Don't release everything all at once. Don't make it all or nothing. Either buy everything and or never play the game.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. It's a thing. So yeah, that's our acquisition disorders this week. We'd love to have all of them, but yeah, monies. So monies. There you go, people.
That is probably the most money we have collectively presented in an acquisition disorder in a while.
I think so.
That's hundreds of dollars. If somebody's like, yeah, I want all of those. Like, ooh, that's a lot of money, buddy.
That's a lot of money. So hopefully you get those to the table somehow, some way. And if you do, invite us over because we'd love to play them. All right. That's everything we want. Anthony, let's talk about the games that did our table this week. And we'll let people know if those games are a buy and they should run out and pick those games up. If those games are a play and they should just sit down and play them. If those games are a dodge and they should avoid them. Or in fact, those games that are dreaded burn, and no matter how much plastic, acrylic, and everything else is in there, they should just burn them, man, because it's just not worth it. I'm just saying. So what did you play this week, Anthony?
All right. I got a new Fabio Lupiano game to the table.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. Co-designed with Mandela Fernandez Grendon.
All right.
Who has previously designed a couple of smaller games, Glasgow and Overstocked, both interesting, but not like this big. This is the heaviest game I think Lupiano has worked on. It is quite heavy. I was surprised because when I play a Fabio Lupiano game, what I expect is mid-weight with a lot of interesting deep decisions, but not broad decisions, right? It's very... You can make it as complex as you need it to, and there's a lot to unpack there, but the games are relatively short, typically, right? Kalamala, Ragusa, Merv, Zapotec, they kind of all have the same profile at the table. This is, like, big, sprawling, takes up a lot of space, takes up a lot of time. The box says 2.5 to 3 hours, which is probably accurate. The weight rating right now on BGG is over 4. That might be accurate. The game is a little complex, but only because of the layers that it offers. So here's what it is. It is a game that takes place in 14th century Timbuktu in West Africa. And you are managing one of the schools of the University of Timbuktu, right? So that the emperor at the time, Mansa Musa, wants you to spread the knowledge throughout West Africa from University of Sankore. And so you are doing a bunch of different things. And by a bunch, I mean a bunch. There's a lot of actions here to try to... you're not even generating points during the game. You're generating these different influence pieces that become worth points based on another factor, right? So the thing that I would say about this game to pay the most attention to is that there's a lot of layers to it, right? It's got a lot of depth, a lot of layers, a lot of things that kind of build over time. When you take an action, you have several different things you could do, right? So you could have students that you recruit because you, again, are running a school. And you are putting on classes and you need students to go into those classes. You could teach the class, which is the most common thing you do in the game. But again, you need students there to be able to do that. Or you can do one of these other, you could graduate a student out, make them worth points, or generate resources, basically. Once you've taken that action, there's often then a secondary action from the board associated with the thing you just did, right? So you have a whole layer of actions, and then underneath that is a whole other layer of actions. And then in some cases, there's another layer below that. The main thing here, though, is you are teaching classes. You have these students. They move up onto these tiles. You will draft tiles throughout the game from a display, and the tiles have special abilities on them. So when you move a student onto that tile, you will teach the class, which involves activating any automation bonuses, and then taking your special action, if the student matches the type of class, so if you have a law student on a law class, you get an extra bonus. You don't have to, though. You could take a mathematics student and put them in a law class. And then you take the board action associated with that class. So there's a section for each of the four subjects, law, mathematics, theocracy, and it's not travel, but like it's travel. It's a map where you're moving around. And then you take that action as well. And those actions all are part of kind of this resource wheel where if you go to travel, you're spending gold to get salt and expanding your influence. If you go to theocracy, you are spending salt to get books. If you go to mathematics, you're spending books to get gold. So everything kind of feeds into each other. You have to spread out. You have to do these different things. And then the law section allows you to kind of upgrade your personal board, which will make your other actions more efficient over time. So every action you take affects every other action you take. It feels almost like a Lacerda game, but a little more abstract because it is fairly abstract. So learning this game is kind of a headache. The rules are not fantastic, but also just, again, it's layer upon layer of rules. So everything you do is then affected by a bunch of other stuff you will do later. So you really... Like, if you're going to teach this game, if you're going to sit down and play it with people, you kind of just have to be like, it's a learning game. You're not going to get it. You just got to go through it, do all the actions. You'll see how they work. And then when we're done, you can look back and say, oh, this is how I could have done this. This is the type of engine I could have built. These are the things I should have done first based on what was available. You have some objective cards at the start of the game that kind of give you direction because the game is so sprawling and broad. And they're things like, you know, have 2 trading posts on this part of the map or, you know, go into 2 locations within Theocracy and pull books out. So it's kind of giving you some direction to work towards. So it's not just like staring at this big sprawling board of like 500 options. Man, what am I supposed to do here? And then the scoring on this ultimately is a little abstract as well. So you don't score any points during the game at all. At the end of the game, you look at your personal space and you look to see how many of these little icons you've uncovered for each of the 4 subjects. Now, they're not necessarily worth anything because there's a separate library board that throughout the game you're putting books onto. Whenever you spend a book, it goes to the library board. And there are multiple rows on that board. In each row, you look to see which subject has the most books. That subject is now worth 2 points. The one with the second most is now worth 1 point. So you could collect a bunch of law tokens throughout the game, and if the law books don't make up a majority or secondary majority in any of those are all worth 0 points. So you really have to kind of steer yourself in the direction of doing things, and then you have to try to manipulate the board to get out those books in a way that affect the majority and look to see what other people are doing. It's a lot to keep wrapped around your head, right? It is a heavy game. It is complex in a way that I'm, again, not used to from Lupiano, but it feels like one of his designs, right? Everything's integrated. It's all kind of this efficiency engine building off of that. So I thought this was a fantastic experience. I wish it was easier to learn and teach, but again, it gave me that Lacerda feel of like, get over that hump and it all kind of flows. It all makes sense. It's Unitool artwork. So maybe that's part of why it feels like a Lacerda. It's beautiful to look at. I was very pleasantly surprised. Now I will say it is very expensive. So if you can find, you know, a discounted copy somewhere, I think the retail on this is like 90, but there's a lot in the box. And this is just what people charge for games now, which is stupid. It's a good production. I'm not unhappy with the production. It's Osprey Games, so it's a beautiful production. And it's got the same style as like Merv, so I could put them on the shelf next to each other.
Great. Sure.
But it's a buy for me. I thought it was really interesting. I really enjoy it as like a follow-up to Merv, another game which I really enjoyed with a similar aesthetic. Another game to add to the academia field, which there aren't that many.
Yes.
It's relatively abstract and it is 14th century, so it's not like relevant to today, but it's interesting and it's doing fun things. But it is heavy. Like if you're used to Lopiano's games being 90 minutes, this is not that. This is, you know, 2.5-3 hour game. It's going to take a while to play. And again, do not expect to do well on your first play because the scoring is not intuitive until you've seen it happen. Like, and you can see kind of the flow and which actions you should be focusing on and where you should be moving your stuff. And there's a whole other mechanic I didn't even mention about, like when you take the students, that will accelerate the game in multiple ways. Because there's these tokens that come off based on the actions you take that fill in the central board. And once the central board is full, that's the end of the game. So if people are ignoring the theocracy section, for example, and those four tokens never come out, the game can keep going and going and going, but you can't really ignore that section, right? So it becomes like this interesting push-pull shared mechanism of completing the game, almost like Terraforming Mars, where completing the game won't actually do anything for you personally, but you are actively participating in making that happen. So just a fascinating, interesting experience. It's much deeper than I expected, much more complex, but it was very fulfilling in the end. So Senkore, the Pride of Matsumusa, a very pleasant surprise to start the year.
I did see this at the convention and I was like, Merv, is it you? It was not Merv. It was a lot more complex and big and dynamic than Merv.
Yeah. It's Merv is like the prototypical Fabio Lupiano game. That's the game that takes 90 minutes. You take like 9 actions in the whole thing and you have to be really efficient with them. It's a great game. But it is quick. This is not quick.
It's pretty though. It's got all the
very pretty.
And I mean, Ian O'Toole, man, like, I don't know what award you could give this man, but like, give him something. Like, he's done so much for board game design, artwork. Just, I mean, it's just almost every time I see a game and I'm just like, wow. And then I'm like, oh, okay, Ian O'Toole, like that makes sense. I'm just like, of course, that, you know. And again, we were talking about price between like Queen Games and the Vita Lacerda games. The Vita Lacerda games has Ian O'Toole, and artwork is expensive. Great graphic design is expensive, and both of those things should, you know, get paid for their work. Like, it's so essential to a game, just like having to sit there and make all those decisions and just make it understandable and evoke the theme. And then again, you go back to Feld, who struggled previously with smaller publishers with that green, brown, tan aesthetic that kind of blurred, and they bring it to Queen and Queen Games. Like it's, I don't know. Like I don't want to mischaracterize it, but it's an inferior production for this day and age.
Yeah.
And being that Stefan Feld and being that Queen Games has a couple of bucks in their pocket, I don't understand the weird cartooniness of the city games, and also the graphic design is not good and intuitive. And then I just see, you know, Tool stuff and all the other artists and graphic designers who work alongside. And I'm just like, I don't understand. I just, it's just measures bigger and different. It just is.
Yeah. The thing is, a Queen has like a house style, which I get, but it's not a good house style, and they should change it. Like Bored and Dice had a house style, and everybody told them to change it, and then they did. And we got Barcelona and Nucleum this year, and they look great.
They look great. Yeah.
But then you look at this, and you're like, $90 is a lot. This is a lot of money. But then Queen is telling us those Feld games, the basic versions, are $130.
That's crazy.
I'm like, oh, well, this is a deal if that's the scale we're doing it. And there's a lot in the box here. There's a lot of wood bits. It's most of it's wood, not cardboard. So I don't know. It's all in perspective, I guess. But like, yeah, I look at a game like this, and then I look at that Kickstarter for the Fell games, and yeah, like you said, I'm like, what are we doing here?
They can almost mark it as a weird throwback, because it does have, there was a day and age. I have a version of Glory to Rome that has that kind of weird cartoony artwork and more or less a very serious, hard, crunchy game. And also the graphic design too. It just, Stefan Feld deserves an Ian O'Toole production. I mean, maybe he gets something at some point. I know he's coming out with his Civ game, which looks a little more colorful, maybe a little too, but I don't know. We'll see. But again, I saw this, I went Merv from a distance and I got close and I was like, ooh. And again, it was very intriguing because again, I didn't play it. But you can understand just by looking at the game board how some of the elements work together and just the dynamism that goes into it. I was just like, no, there's something like electric about this. There's something about seeing this at the table and it draws my attention. Osprey did a great job here. Again, obviously Eagle Griffin does a great game with Vitalis Surtis games. I mean, Eon Tool's artwork is carried through in a very good production. I want to play this. I don't want to play the Felds. And if you listen to the podcast that we've been doing for basically 11 years, I would not ever think that would be possible. I would never, because we played Feld with really generic kind of artwork and production, and we loved it. I don't, this stuff, the stuff that you just pulled, just do the thing, man. I'm just saying.
Yeah. It's come a long way. You got to catch up. Come on, catch up.
Breaks my heart. It really does. All right. Awesome. So yeah, I now I want to play that. So
it's good. You will like it.
I'm gonna love it too. Should I buy it or should I just play it first?
Oh, you should play it first. It's expensive. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
The thing about the game is it is, like I said, three or four layers of decision making. It's not like it's not flat, it's tiered. And I it's not that I don't think you'd like it. I just think it's one of those games where if part of that doesn't click, it's the whole thing's not gonna click. So it's worth playing first.
Gotcha. Well, I got to play a very fancy Kickstarter version, I mean, of a game. This is Age of Rome, Ad Glorium. This, Anthony, if you remember way back when, I think we all saw this. This is new designers and new studio coming out with a game that was just like, it kind of blew everyone's mind a little bit because two things. First, the main game board, the section that you're playing on, the map more or less, or row more or less, has this kind of turntable, Lazy Susan situation. So that's interesting and different dynamic. And then it had these acrylic buildings that you would place in different quadrants of this round board that will be turned. And I'll talk about that in a second. So as you placed the tiles, it represented a building that could do a particular production. And as the game goes on, you can upgrade those buildings. Then you would take another acrylic tile placed on top of the previous one. So in effect, those buildings would build up with the tiles. And the initial tile locks in. The other ones are a little, you know, they sit. They sit fine. I'm as long as no one's spinning the board too fast, they're fine. But it's a very good production for an interesting game, because just looking, talking about the artwork and the graphic design, you look at this, nice. You look at the boards, a little asymmetry. I'll talk about that in a second as far as the player board's concerned. And there's also, you could build up a temple, and that has its own kind of dynamics because you're basically putting together a foundation and then the actual temple itself. And, you know, the rest of the production is good. There was a deluxe version and a lesser version as far as production is concerned. The deluxe version is very nice. And I feel like, I think back in the day when we talked about this as an acquisition disorder, this was certainly something I wanted to back. Again, my vibe from it was, considering the price, it seemed very light. And I think it was done purposely so. It was meant to be a lighter kind of Civ game, so to speak. And I love Civ games, so I was really excited about that. But again, great production. The artwork, I think they had some problem with the boards. The game that I played with came with, I guess, some coloring errors with the boards themselves, but there was replacements there. So let me talk about the game itself. Basically, you have one of these leaders of Rome, and they have different starting resources and a particular, how would you say it, assassin kind of mess with your opponent's kind of mechanic that comes into play. You could also have an anchor card that kind of messes with you a little bit. So basically, your player has a slightly different setup than other players. In addition, you also have ways to mess with other players. You can make them lose points. You can make them lose parts of their temple. And then you have a special ability that also messes with other players. And that third ability is different for each player. Slightly different, but it's different nonetheless. So the gameplay itself, as I mentioned, as being a Civ game, is pretty straightforward. On your turn, whatever quadrant of that circle board is kind of facing you, you have the opportunity to build in that area. Buildings are fairly expensive. Money is kind of hard to come by, at least initially. And you are going to build up one of several different types of buildings in the game. There's military buildings, and there's a very small section of the board that has three areas for military conquests where you're going to be fighting as far as majority control. Whoever has the most gets first place, second place, and in some cases there is a third place area. There is a politics building that you could build up. You're basically putting, I guess, people into the Senate, and as you put people in, it knocks people off the bottom. At the end of the game, it scores points, all different levels. Bottom level scores the most points. There's also trade. There's a whole really cool deck mechanic where you're kind of trading with ships and you're out there and you're pulling in different resources. These cards give you special abilities in the game. Very cool. But they also serve as a set collection mechanic that scores you points at the end of the game. So nice. Then there's a religious building situation where you're going to build a pantheon. So this pantheon temple that you're going to be building up comes in different sections. It's kind of a race for the most expensive parts of that pantheon. So there are pieces out, gold, silver, and bronze. So if you're able to build those sections first, you're able to get the special pieces that go on top. Now, the interesting mechanic here is the scheme system. This allows you, as I mentioned earlier, to do something to mess up other players. You basically take your action to put that scheme on the board. And then as the game goes on and the board spins, you can activate it in a certain area and mess with that particular player. Beyond all of that and the money in particular, the really challenging part is the citizens, the population that you're trying to bring into the game, because essentially it's a worker placement game, right? By being able to place your population, your Senate, your citizens out on the board, you're able to activate the ability of that building. And the higher the level is, the more people you could put out there on that section to be able to do whatever particular action that you want to do in the game. So you're building, now here's the kind of twist, and I guess I mean this literally, no pun intended. You're gonna flip over a card at the beginning of the round, and that's going to tell you how the board rotates, clockwise, counterclockwise. There's also a situation of where the star player goes and then how it follows. That also can change. And then it'll also tell you something happens. Typically, it's good or bad, minor, nothing too crazy. Typically, it's a catch-up mechanic. But the citizen worker placement situation is really the challenge, because you need to score points early and often in order to race up that track to unlock extra followers. Once you have those extra followers in hand, again, you'll be able to take additional actions. When you do, the level that is necessary to recruit that particular follower moves down. So there's a catch-up mechanic for other people behind you to be able to get that follower. So I got the follower. Great. It now becomes 1 point cheaper to get that follower. The next person gets it, keeps moving down. Weird to see such a blatant catch-up mechanic. Not a bad thing necessarily, but just interesting to see that there. You know, it's just different. I don't think I've seen that so just built into the hardcore part of the game. Usually it's like a card or a random event, but this is actually built into the game. So as you pick up followers, you'll be able to do additional things throughout the game. But primarily, you're going to be focusing on building buildings and then placing workers. But as you do your thing, you built your buildings, you placed your workers, right? Everyone builds, everyone places workers or followers in this case. And then you get money or, again, you get Senate votes or you get to build up the Pantheon and such. Then, again, because that card came out, as it does every round, the board moves. So what you just did becomes somebody else's territory that they can now build on and they can place out their followers and benefit from. So there's not a large deck, but there's, you know, enough cards that anything can happen. In the game I played, me and the partner, the opponent across from me, directly across from me, we swapped boards back and forth multiple times. So that was kind of, I guess, random as far as the cards coming out. So as he built, I built, we went back and forth, back and forth. And I was building and noticing the card that determined what movement was. It helped me figure out, do I want to build up this particular area? Because I'm going to hand that over to my opponent and they'll be able to use it. But I see what they might be building. So now I know typically what I'm going to be able to do my next round based upon that. So that's a really interesting mechanic. It's a love or hate kind of situation because you may benefit from that other person or may not based upon their gameplay. And you might be somewhat stuck on not being able to take a lot of actions in your section because just the way the wheels spinned, people weren't able to do what you needed them to do. So at the end of the game, I wanted to do a lot of things. Thankfully, the section of board that I got allowed me to do that. I was able to build up a couple of areas, but it really determined what I was able to do. If certain areas weren't built up initially and I didn't have a lot of money, I wouldn't have been able to do much of anything anyway. It really determined my actions. I thought at the start of the game, it was going to be a focus to one area or the other. Maybe it's military, or maybe I'm going to go Senate, or maybe I'm going to go trade. I'm going to do one thing and then maybe something else. Because typically when you do a Civ game, you want to do a little bit of everything, but there's usually not an opportunity to do everything. At the end of the game, my Pantheon was completely built. The Senate vote was mostly mine. I hit a little on the military, and the trade I purposely stayed away from because two other players had an effect that could mess with my trade. So I just like didn't really want to bother. I didn't think I was going to be able to do that much anyway, but I could. And at the end of the game, I was like, I could do all these things. I won by a lot of points, but I don't know if I deserve to do so because, again, I didn't necessarily build up that area that came to me at the end of the game. I was just prepared for that area to come into my hands to be able to do a lot with it. So I think a lot of the game comes down to the randomness of the cards as far as spinning the board. Also what the other players are able to do in the game. A lot of randomness, a lot of chance, some strategic gameplay, some tactical gameplay as far as what you're going to be able to do based on what's thrown your way. But there is a large element of luck to this game. There just is. It's a lighter game. It's typically a quicker game. I didn't feel like the schemes really played enough into it because it is, you have to take an action to be able to do so, but when you do the scheme, you can mess with other players and stop them from getting bonuses. There's also bonus tokens on your board that you can kind of, you know, gain an additional thing, whether it's an additional vote or additional card or such. Didn't play major into the game, but obviously that's another component or portion into the game. The game also has some small add-on expansions, some modules that you can come into play. Didn't get to play with them, so this is not a full review. I'd like to play it multiple times to see how much the luck factor comes into play. But it's such a light game that I felt confident to review it. I read through a bunch. I watched a couple of videos online. I'd like to play it again just to see about the chance in the gameplay. But I don't think, based upon the turning, that strategically there's enough for me to feel like I did a thing. I don't, like, there's some decisions, but there's not a lot of interesting decisions because whatever I'm doing is getting passed off randomly to someone else. And then maybe I'll see it again, or maybe I get someone else's stuff. I get it. I like the mechanic. It's fun and interesting for a lighter game. And I think inevitably when you play it multiple times, you could speed through it. I don't feel like this is an earned victory game. It's fine. It gets a play for me. I definitely recommend playing this. If you do see it at this table, you should play it. So it's slightly on the expensive side, but considering the interesting speed dials and the acrylic kind of chips, it's worth checking out. That's Age of Rome Ad Gloriam.
It looks pretty. Yeah, I mean, it's always tough, like, when you describe that type of thing, like, the mechanics and the catch-up elements and all that, I don't know. I could see why it would kind of fall not quite to the point where you want it to.
It's, like I said, you scheme, you build, you take actions, you get income, there's a way to give up points for additional monies. So I think there's always things that you're able to do. I just didn't feel like I did anything real on my side. Like, I made some good decisions, or I looked in advance and saw what I could possibly do, but I felt those were really small. I didn't, you know, usually when you play a game that's a city building game, economics, whatever, you feel like you did things. Like, I did things. I had a strategy. I planned. I sent out troops. I did some political stuff. I built up this thing. I didn't feel that very strongly here. And again, it's a lighter game, so maybe that's just a thing. Or maybe you could use an expansion just to kind of make it a little more intense in some ways. So, yeah, Age of Rome. It's got about 2.53 weight on Board Game Geek, and it seems about right. And one final game that I want to just mention. I got to play a party game that was a review copy that was sent our way. It's called Think Like a Shrink. Fake Therapy, Real Hilarity, a Party Game. What's really interesting about this and what kind of drew my attention was this was created by two friends who are actually in the industry, a psychologist and a psychiatrist. And they made a board game. That's a party game. So I was like, cool, because that's my field of study too, as well as Will's, and this is right up our alley. So it's a party game, and typically party games come, at least as I feel, come down to two major areas, you know, some exceptions. One is everyone tries to guess what one person is doing, or the opposite. And this game comes down to everyone guessing what one person might think. So basically, if you are the patient at this point, what's going to happen is you are going to have a prompt. And the prompt could be something like, you thought your webcam was off. Okay. And then there are going to be different little small pictures, snapshots. And you're also going to have a player board. That patient is going to pick what snapshot they feel like best represents that prompt. They're also going to write a rationale for why those two things connect. And then finally, they're going to pick an emotion that goes along with that. And you'll have a little emotion tiles as well. Everyone else at the table will try to guess. They'll point out which picture they think it is. They'll have their own emotion tile. And they'll also have an opportunity to guess what the rationale was for it. That's pretty much the whole game. The prompts themselves were not particularly funny. The snapshots had some cute, sometimes very basic kind of pictures. And I guess again, depending on the random snapshots that come out and some of the prompts, there could be some smiles or kind of laughs. And then the emotions are just general emotions. We didn't feel, we played this party game several times at the table with different people, did not get a chance to play this with our resident psychologist, but I was kind of lost as far as how the prompts match with the snapshots, match with the emotions and the rationales. The rationales were really hard to figure out why someone said something. And it became frustrating as the game went on, because basically the snapshots don't have necessarily any connections to the prompts whatsoever. And the prompts were also pretty random. So prompts, snapshots, sometimes you guessed correctly out of the selection there, but they are so typically different that there's no rhyme or reason why somebody would pick it other than it's the only thing there or out of the five. So that was a thing. And then the emotion cards, again, if you didn't get the snapshot correctly, typically you didn't get the emotion correctly, or you thought your webcam was off. So maybe you're surprised by that. Maybe you're angered by that. I don't know. Maybe you pick a picture of gummy bears because gummy bears. So I was disappointed that there wasn't a more thoughtful connection between therapy and what was happening in this game. I felt it was just a lot of randomness and random guessing. Even if you knew the people really well, and I played with some people that I knew quite well, sometimes just because of the pictures that became available, they had to pick something random that would they thought somewhat matched what they wanted. But again, there's a lot of pictures that come to the game. Maybe if there was fewer snapshots, you could focus on it. And then the rationales, even if you, I think we got one rationale. So it was a rather disappointing game experience. Again, we've seen other games like this who, you know, try to guess what someone's thinking matches up and then based upon why. So think like a shrink. Love the idea. Love the concept, especially two friends coming together to produce a great game. Love the idea of the whole idea of therapy mechanic. I wish it was actual, like, gamified. I wish there was some real therapy situation instead of, like, guessing, right? Because this game could have been, like, guess what someone's random thinking based upon random things. So it gets a dodge. And again, we got a review copy of this. We appreciate them sending us out. But we hope that they take a look at this again and maybe there's a future version that's a little bit more hilarious. All right, I think that's everything that hit the table this week. Let's talk about our feature review. Our feature review, of course, is Stonemaier Games. And in particular, a lovely tier list to show how much we love Stonemaier Games. And as always, how we feel things should be rated, because that's the way life is.
Everything's got to fall in a category.
That's it. That's where we live now. Everything needs to be a category. There's no gray zone. There's no spectrum. Everything's got to be in a box. I don't know why. Why?
And this is definitive, so you can't tell us we're wrong, because nope. This is it. Tie it up. Put a bow on it. This is it.
For all time and for all people, this is the one and only Stonemaier game tier list. Hold on to your hats or meeples. And Anthony, I'm gonna lead us off on this. What list are we looking at here? What's our games here? What are we doing?
All right, so we got 15 games that have been published by Stonemaier Games over the last 10-12 years. Tapestry, Charterstone, Expeditions, Libertalia, Winds of Galecrest, Euphoria, Apiary, Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig, Between Two Cities, My Little Scythe, Red Rising, Rolling Realms, Pendulum, Scythe, Wingspan, and Viticulture. So we'll go through them one at a time, assign it to one of five categories. Again, we're using our rating scale, buy, play, dodge, burn, and then the must buy.
Oh.
So let's kick it off with Tapestry. This list is kind of in random order. So we'll start off with Tapestry. This is the Civilization game. It came out about 5 years ago now. Crazy. Mm-hmm. And it had all the little buildings. That was the thing everybody's excited about. But it was $100. Nobody was excited about that.
this is way
expansions and like 5 or 6 revisions to the rules. So
this is way back in the day where games didn't all cost $100. I think we should make that note.
That is true. If this came out now, it'd be $150, $200, $300. Who knows?
That's true. Because they had very nicely painted miniature buildings that went onto the board and didn't seem to like affect gameplay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We got a review copy of this. I played it a bunch before I reviewed it.
Yep.
I honestly don't remember where I landed on this for the official review, whether it was a play or a dodge. It was very close in that range for me. I didn't love it because, honestly, the balance issues. And when I played it, I always felt like I got to the end and ran out of stuff to do and max out multiple tracks and be like, what am I doing now?
Mm-hmm.
So, admittedly, I've not played with all the upgrades since and all the rebalancing, but I don't love that you have to do that. So I'm not a fan of giving Stonemaier games a pass when they haven't. Like, if you can go buy this game in the store and this is what you're getting and that was my experience, I'm happy to rate that. So I test this one in kind of the dodge category because I did get rid of it after I played it. Where's it for you? Because I think I gave it to you. So.
You did. And that shows how much love we have between us. I played this several times. I love civ building games, as I know you do. And I think that was certainly your disappointment because you're a big Civ fan, even more so than I. And the production of this was great. I mean, the artwork was great. The graphic design is great. And, you know, we're people who love tracks. So if you say, hey, what do you love most about Civ games? It's going to be the tech trees. Like building and opening up different tech that allows you to kind of expand and all the other kind of X's that come along with the game. Awesome. Love that. A game about tech trees? Love it. Great. Awesome. And then there was all the problems that came along with it. And I think initially it was like we try to kind of like it just try to manage it, try to figure it out, and it just wasn't working. The expansion came out along with an errata to kind of fix certain things. There were certain problems with the cards and balance issues and such. And then there was the expansions. I have not played the expansion, so there's a little asterisk that goes along with this. But the base game for me, I think like you, was between a play and a dodge. Just because there's no reason this game shouldn't be a buy or a must buy. It's Stonemaier Games. It's a Civ game. The production was top notch. Really cool ideas coming into play here. But it also is a very abstracted, weirdly abstracted kind of game because you would have, like, you go to space. You would literally go to space, but also not have fire. I mean, I'm making that up because, again, I don't remember necessarily. But there was things where, like, you were so advanced in one area, but not the other. So that was kind of a thing. So I think just because it could have been so much more, and again, the expansions might have corrected this, but as you said, Anthony, I don't think necessarily the expansions should have to. I think expansions should do awesome things, except, of course, bring 5 people to the table, but I think it's a dodge. The base game itself, in its initial iteration, it's a dodge. I don't think you should have to buy an expansion in order for a base game to play well.
Yeah, and I think more than any other publisher, we're going to find that a lot of these games would probably rate higher if we threw all the expansions in the box. We're not going to do that, but we will certainly indicate when that would be the case, to be fair. Because some of these games are better with their expansions, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, next up, Charterstone. This is the first game from Stonemaier where I was like, oh, what's happening here? It's a legacy experience. Both of us completed this around the time it came out. Mm-hmm. Again, we received a review copy of this. And we famously ranted for, I don't know, a good 10 to 15 minutes about the stupid candle in the game. Spoilers, I guess, for this 8-year-old game. Charterstone. I can't remember where I landed on it. I think I left it at a dodge. I don't think I burned it, but... No, I know I didn't burn it because there were parts of it I did like, but I certainly didn't recommend going out buying it to anybody.
Yeah, this was another hotly anticipated game. A Euro game that's a legacy game that you get to build up the board. I think you had gotten a review copy. I didn't, but I had purchased the game along with a recharge pack. That's how confident I was about this game. A friend of mine had already bought it, set up a game group. I was playing with them, and the candle was a thing. I won't spoil the end of the story, but the end of the story, that's a thing too. That's a weird, weird thing to come into play. The gameplay itself, again, was disappointing, to say the least. And again, I think the gameplay alone, because you can play the game once the board is completed. My game group played it. I, as a reviewer, needed to play the game itself once it was done and over with, because again, there's another way to play it. And they did not want to play the finished completed game, the board. And we just never came back to it. Like, I played other people's later on, but this was, again, a tremendously disappointing, I mean, great concept, amazing concept. Because again, I love legacy games. I love Euro games. If you could put those two together, excellent. It just never came together. It's just, you know, just how people were fortunate enough to build certain spots on the board and just leaned on it the entire game. It's a disappointing Euro. It's a tragically bad legacy game. And I don't know. Both of those things should not be true. So I don't remember offhand. We did not look back at the reviews. We wanted to make this fresh and clean. This was either a dodge or a burn for me. So we did our recent burn list. It didn't come up, at least initially. So at the very least, this is a dodge.
Yeah, I think we both did dodges on it. I might have been nice and given it a play, but in retrospect, I wouldn't play it again. So that is Charterstone falling in the dodge category. Next up, we have Expeditions, a game I know you have not had a chance to play this yet, right?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So I'll talk about this one. I did not formally review it on the podcast. This was not a review copy. I paid for it. And part of the reason for that is I really, really, really did not like it. So you're like, why not do a negative review? And I'm like, well, because I would have to play it more. And I didn't want to.
Oh, no. So That's even worse.
I played it once, and then I played it the solo time, and I'm like, I don't want to do that again, and I don't feel comfortable reviewing it without having played it a little bit more if I'm going to, like, rip into it. So, but for this exercise, because these aren't ratings, these are tiers, I'm going to throw it in the burden category. I really didn't enjoy this game very much, and I got rid of it very recently. Somebody got a nice, inexpensive copy of Expeditions with all the metal figures in it.
Wow.
I don't like that they threw the Scythe name on, and I'm not the world's biggest Scythe fan. We'll get to that one in a bit, but it just doesn't feel like Scythe. The artwork's there, but that's about it. And then everything else just kind of, I don't know. It was not a good experience for me.
Ah, that's too bad. Yeah, I haven't got a chance to play this. We'll talk about Scythe in a minute. I was looking forward to playing this. We saw this at Gen Con, and I've heard a lot of things beyond, again, we've talked about this off mic. We haven't talked about this as a review, but I've heard a lot of things from other media people and a lot of people at the table with a lot of challenges about this game. So terribly disappointed. Really was really excited about this.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, like, seeing other people's ratings and talking to other people, I think I'm way more negative than the average person. And don't use this as like a review to be like, oh, Anthony hates it, it's a terrible game. I just really dislike it. Like, for me, it was not a good experience. So, All right, next up, Libertalia Winds of Galecrest, the re-implementation of Libertalia, Palomori's classic pirate game. Now all the pirates are animals, and everything's bright and colorful.
Yay!
And it's a great, solid, engaging, almost party-like experience, but with, like, some game elements to it. I was pleasantly surprised. I think I gave it a play in my review. I did pass it along to you because it's the type of game you would play more than me, but I do like it.
Yeah, no, I do like it a lot myself, and I did play Libertaria, the original, and a bunch before playing this new version. And as you said, it's brighter, it's more colorful, the animals add, I think, a lot more fun to the game. I think and it's still kind of very piratey theme. Like, it's not cutesy kind of theme. It is really laid out there in a good way. The board's good. The artwork's good. It's a fun game to play. It's definitely a play for me as well.
All right. Next up, we have Euphoria, Build a Better Dystopia. It's going back to the early days of Stonemaier, one of the first games, if not the first. I don't recall. I think this was second. I think Viticulture was first. It's been a hot minute since I played this game, but I do remember thinking, really cool idea, really interesting way of engaging with the game space, but some wonkiness for sure in there. That apparently, again, addressed by the expansion, which eventually came out after we played it. I didn't hate it, though. I don't remember hating this game. I just remember being like, cool, I played it, I'm good. If someone threw it in the table, I would do it again.
Yeah, we played this way, way back in the day when it first came out. This was one of the kind of original games that we reviewed. And as you mentioned, Anthony, I think it did. It was wonky. I think it was obtuse. We played with so many different players because once people played it, they didn't really want to play it again. And again, obviously, now that we see that there's actually problems with the game that hopefully were fixed. Did not play the expansion. I cannot get anyone else to play this at the table because they had a bad taste in their mouth with the original game. So, again, good theme, good idea, dystopian. How do you kind of manage that city? It's certainly a dodge, I think, on the rating scale.
All right. Next up is Apiary. You talked about this one being hot at the convention recently. Yep. I played this. I just reviewed it. I gave it a buy, so I'll stick with that. Really enjoyed this. I think this might be my new favorite game from Stonemaier.
Wow.
Not necessarily to spoil the list, but I really quite enjoyed it a lot. Doing some interesting things. The only problem I really have with the game is that I feel like the theme is... it's not that I think it's silly, it's that I think it's unnecessary and it gets in the way a little bit.
Yeah, that's my initial impression of the game, just looking at it. I was just like, really? Good? Because you had this as a buy, and I was just like, honestly, like, I would never just pick this up just because it just didn't seem to be something. Like, it seemed like a hodgepodge of stuff at the table and without no rhyme or reason to it. So I'm glad you like it, because now I have to play this thing.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, next up we have Between Two Cities, and in the same conversation we can talk about Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig, because it uses the same mechanics. Between Two Cities, though, came first. We played this one when it was in prototype, right? Way back in the day when it was going up on Kickstarter,
yep.
Back when Stonemaier still ran their stuff on Kickstarter. And it is a game where you are building two cities with the two people sitting to your left and your right. And then you score them out and you see which is your lowest scoring, and that is your ultimate score, and whoever has the highest low score wins. It's a great game, plays very quickly and simultaneously across the board. And the newer version of it, which I reviewed back in the fall, comes with the expansion kind of packed in and some tweaks to the rules. I really like it because it plays up to seven quickly, right? You can throw this at a table with seven people. It's like, this is the alternative when people say they're tired of Seven Wonders. I'm like, well, we could try set Between Two Cities. Plays about the same length. It's got a drafting element. It's really good with seven. So for me, this has always been like just a solid buy. It's never really changed. I've always really enjoyed this game.
Yeah, this is, are we talking about both of them at the same time, or are we splitting this up a little bit?
Because I think we can just finish out Between Two Cities, because I think Mad King kind of spins off of that,
sure,
in a few interesting ways. So
I like this. I didn't like this as much as you. I thought the initial production of it was beyond bland and beyond just dry and flat and uninteresting, whereas the game is just primarily those tiles. There's nothing else to the game other than those tiles. So when that was kind of uninteresting, splitting those things up as far as maybe I'll go for this because now I'm building two cities, so which whatever one kind of benefits and the other player's interaction is interesting and different. At the time, it was just like, whoa, we've never seen this in a game before, where you're partnering with your opponents to build two cities up, but at the same time you're trying to get the better of the two. It's just solidly in the play area for me. Not as far as a buy, but I certainly, considering the number of players and the interesting mechanic there, I could see that. I wouldn't be against it, but I don't think it rises to the level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that last thing, though, that you said, because I, you know, ultimately as a game, I'd be like, sure, it's a play. But because it plays so well at higher player counts in a way that a lot of games can't, and it is relatively short, like that 20-25 minute length, I think it does, like, bump that up a little bit.
Sure.
It's one of those games, even times when I haven't played much, I'm like, I just keep this around because it's a game I can bring when I know there's a lot of people and we have that option.
Yeah, it's open information as well. Because you flip the tiles over and then, like, what are we going to do? And you can actually even talk to your opponent and be like, hey, what does this do, that do, this do, that do? So, yeah, I can see that.
All right. And so then the spinoff of this, Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig, which is like a little experiment that they did with Bezier, is the same mechanic where you're building two castles, but now with significantly more complicated synergies. Between Two Cities, the synergies are very simple.
Yeah,
like you're just trying to, there's a different scoring mechanism for each of the five types of buildings, and they're pretty straightforward. With Mad King, you have the scoring of Mad King, and it is a headache, and one of the harder games to score out at the end that I've ever played. And because you have upwards of six different castles at the table, you kind of have to go through and score each of them individually, and it takes a long time. People get really frustrated. So I loved the idea of this game. I very much did not enjoy teaching it or scoring it. The play was fine, but it is very much a dodge for me because the experience was bad. The game is interesting. The experience of playing it, not so much. It'd be a better video game. Like, it's too much tracking on the table.
So everything you said, I think, other than I really love Mad King Ludwig, and I love the fact that, like, the artwork is better here. It's interesting synergies. As you said, there's a lot of them, but I had the same separate experience. I own this because, again, Mad King Ludwig and Between Two Cities, why not? It's like peanut butter and jelly. It's like, yeah, I love that. And then you get to the table and nobody wants to score their castle. And I'm just like, I have to score everyone's thing. And they're like, yeah, I have to score everyone's thing. You brought the game. You want us to play the game. And I was like, this, you got to add the numbers on. I was like, I was wishing or thinking, like, could there be an app for this where I just hold my phone over it and it just scans all the things and does the numbers?
Yeah.
And it's a lot of, I mean, you legitimately almost in a way spend more time scoring the game than you do playing the game.
You absolutely do. Yeah. It's terrible.
Again, it's a fun game. I think that's the perfect thing to say. Like, this should be an app. This would be a great app. This would be a great app to play, but terrible to score. So,
yeah,
just because of the scoring, I would go along with that. Otherwise, decent, just scoring. I don't, you know.
Yeah, no, it's one of those ones. It got it in as a review copy, played it, and I was like, ah, I like it, but I can't recommend it.
I can't, well, it's again, I like it, and maybe I'd play with you, but I would never bring that to a game night. I would. No.
I made that mistake once. I'm never doing it again. All right. Next up, we have My Little Scythe. And again, we haven't talked about Scythe yet, which we'll get to. But My Little Scythe is a great story of the father and daughter team kind of designing a kid's version of this on Board Game Geek. And then Stonemaier picking up that game and publishing it. And then later releasing an expansion for it. You get the little chibi versions of the Scythe figures. You get, like, a simplified version of the map. It's a fairly straightforward game, so, like, it plays to pretty young. I played it with my daughter when she was like 5 or 6. It's very cute. The only issue I have with the game, which is a silly issue, it's not really an issue, is that it is very kid focused. It's not really a family game. It is a kid game, and so the kids outgrew it, and I didn't play it anymore, and I passed it on to someone else. That's not a bad thing. It's just me personally. I don't own it anymore because who would I play this with? So, at the time, though, when I got it in, it was definitely a buy for me. And if you have children and like Scythe, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, and again, I think and we've done a list about this. I don't think this was on the list, surprisingly, Anthony. We should have thought about this one as well. Children's game are great gateway games. In fact, they're typically sometimes better than gateway games for non-gamers. And I mean legitimately non-gamers. I don't mean about like people who play like, oh yeah, I play Carcassonne and Catan. Like, no, non-gamers. This right. is a great game for non-gamers to get them into gaming. So same thing, I think, on this. Either a play or buy, again, depending on the audience. Maybe play because it's a little redundant because Scythe. But yeah, certainly up there on the list.
Yeah, I'm cool with putting it in the play category. Yeah. Because again, if you have kids and you like Scythe, definitely play it. Pick it up if you think they'll play it more.
But. Absolutely. Agreed.
All right. Next up, we have a game that I was very excited about. And I was very excited to find out that Jamie Stegmaier had like the same love for this book series that I do. Red Rising. And so this is basically Fantasy Realms, but with a lot more cards in the deck and themed after the Red Rising book series. And I was like, that's awesome. Because it's a good game and a good book series, and the artwork's amazing, and the production looks great. And it fell kind of flat for me because there are so many cards in the deck, and it was difficult to get the synergies that you needed out of that deck to be able to do it what you wanted to do. It felt like one of those games, like, great in theory, doesn't work if the cards don't come out, and that's just what happened. So I ultimately was like, I remember reviewing this and giving a very disappointed dodge rating to it, because I was like, man, I really want to like it. I still own it just because I like the theme and I don't want to get rid of it. Like, cool artwork on the cards, but I wouldn't recommend necessarily playing it. I just personally own it for IP reasons.
I did not play it, so I can't speak to it. I remember your review of it, so ergo, did not play it.
Yeah. All right, Rolling Realms is the multiverse roll and write that Stonemaier has built out. This game originally launched, basically you have like different cards and scoring options for each realm that's in the game. You select a certain number, I can't remember exactly how many, it's like five, I think. And then you do things to try to score on each of them, right? The base game comes with all of Stonemaier's games up to that point. So this was like 2020. So it was like up through the Pendulum was the last one. And it was fine. And I was like, this is a cool idea. And then they had a promo for Terra Mystica. And I was like, ooh, okay. So if you do this, but then you do all the games in the world, this becomes a very interesting, like, multiversal roll and write. And that's exactly what they've done, right? There are now, I think, 30 or so different packs you can get for this for all sorts of games. Ark Nova and Terra Mystica and all these different games, and you can pick and choose because you don't need all of them. It's a good roll and write. It's not a great roll and write. It's a good one. It's interesting. This was like based on a print and play thing that Stegmaier did during COVID. But when you throw in all like the IP stuff and all the different mechanics and like have all these different packs that you can buy, which are only like $4 or $5 each, it becomes like such a cool experience. That I've kept up with. So it's, to me, a buy, almost a must buy, just because it's such a cool thing to have. And he's doing like a big box version of this soon. It's just, I like that it exists. Even if I don't play it as much as it sounds like I should be.
Yeah, I have not played this, so I'm really glad to hear that it's doing well.
Yeah, it is good stuff. Pendulum. Where do we want to put this guy? This is, I don't know if it was disappointing necessarily, because I don't know who was expecting much out of like any real-time game, but the general gaming sphere did not like Pendulum.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy about that because only a few review copies came out to a couple of reviewers and they did not like it at all. And yeah, there was bad blood, let's say that. And then eventually everyone got to play it, and now currently you could get it for about $8 to $10 online in certain places. So yeah, it's, I think it is sadly enough, again, love the artwork, love the concept of it. It's just, I think it's a better game in theory, or even maybe a better game online as an app, because racing to do actions and then everyone else racing to do actions and everyone hopefully being honest with racing doing their actions just doesn't really work well in a practical tabletop form. So
yeah.
Hopefully this gets an online version, but in the meantime, it's bad, man. It is way bad. It is, yeah.
All right, so that leaves us with the kind of the big three. So there you go. We can figure out where we want to put these at the top of the list here. First up, we got Viticulture.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the all-time classic worker placement game about wine. I always really enjoyed it. It's back in the day, it was confusing which version you're supposed to play and what modules you're supposed to play with. But these days, you just buy Viticulture and it comes with everything that makes the game as good as it can be. It's a top 100 game on Board Game Geek. It is. There are several good worker placement games to start people out with. This is one of them. It's not like some people say this is the one. I would argue with that because it just depends on the theme you want. But it is one of them. One of the better ones to start with. I would consider this a solid buy. What about you?
I think the thing that always throws me about this game is it's a good game. And again, we're going with the games and we're not going with all the expansions and the essential upgrades because, again, this game has been revised and expanded. I think the visitors, the deck of visitors that come into play shifts the game pretty radically. And if you do well with the cards, excellent. If you do poorly, sucks to be you. And I think one of the other challenges with the game is that it could go on for a very long time. This is not a number of rounds. This is a number of stars. And that lengthens this game to an uncomfortable length sometimes, because again, visitors kind of determine a lot of the speed and profitability of certain players. So I own this game. I purchased this game. I guess I purchased the essential edition with the Tuscany and all that kind of fun stuff. I could see buying it, but it's also kind of a play. So, yeah. I mean, I think the popular, you know, I guess for me, it's going to be a play. I could see buying it. I could see people buying it. Anthony, I'll let you kind of, if you would like to buy it, then we'll buy it. Okay. I don't think it's a must buy. I think if the people visiting came in, I think that would be a situation where it would be a must buy. But I think it's, I could see as a pull. I could see. All right, let's buy it. Let's just buy it, man. Let's buy it now.
All right, we're buying it. We bought it. Viticulture's been bought.
But maybe I have to now send something away from Dodge because it just, yeah. Maybe Pendulum just drops down to burn. I'm just saying, I can't afford everything, man. I just can't afford it.
We want to drop Pendulum to burn?
I think we do. Yeah, I think it just doesn't work. It's kind of broke.
Yeah. All right. Wingspan.
Yeah, I mean, I infinitely want to take credit for the fact that, like, I was like, this is going to be a thing, and turns out it's a thing, and it's still a thing. Even now, worms are a thing, so it's a thing. It's certainly a buy. I think it's hard to argue it's not a buy. I don't know if it's a must buy, and again, especially with the initial combinations. Again, this has multiple expansions. I've played, I believe I played all the expansions.
Mm-hmm.
The expansions are there, obviously, to kind of fill in some of the gaps, right? Some add some additional scoring, take some weight off those infinite combos that come into the game. Just by chance, you get two cards and they score like a ton of points where somebody else, you know, fills out their board and still doesn't even come close. So I can't give it a must-buy for that, even with the expansions, but I could certainly see this as a buy and or a play. I think it fits into the Viticulture kind of feel. I feel like solid game, replayability, general public appeal, I think is strong here, and it's lasted. It's in the top 100, give or take. It's somewhere high up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those games. Like, it's not my favorite version of this, but I fully recognize how good it is.
Mm-hmm.
And would gladly sit down and play anytime we pull it out. Someone's like, we're gonna play Wingspan. I'm like, cool, I'll play Wingspan. Great. I think it's a buy. I think it fits that category based, especially like when we're looking at it in comparison to the rest of these games. And that's the goal of a tier list, right? It's not like what are our ratings, it's like how do these games rank against each other. I think it's up there.
Yeah, if we have to take the Stonemaier game list, the breadth of their collection, I think certainly it makes sense. It fits along with that Viticulture kind of theme. Like, it's got some problems and issues, but it's like a Nolan movie. Like, it's got enough solidness that you could kind of, you know, ignore the gaps and the problematic combos.
Right. All right. Last but not least, we have Scythe, the big one, the one that kind of blew Stonemaier up big enough to kind of become this tier A game publisher. Where do we put Scythe on the list?
Well, you want to go back way back, like how many years ago that we did our predictions with our friend Drew? I'm like, Drew, it's going to make the most money on a game that's not an IP thing. And he's like, no, I'm like, yeah, and it did. It made all the monies for its particular class of and type of game. I still love Scythe. I think the Rise of Fenris makes it a must buy. But again, I don't think it's fair because we have not been considering the expansions as part of our kind of tier list, so to speak. Again, it's a whole different list for a whole different day. As it is, and again, because there's also two more factions and there's flying ships and stuff like that, I still think it's a buy. I think it's easy for that game to be not fun because of reasons, because again, I think the problem with the game has always been it has mechs, it has battling, and yet it's a Euro game. I think Fenris fixes that, but everyone who's played it and walked away not liking it typically is because both of those things are in there and neither one are super strong. So, but you could do both of them, so that's also good. But also at the same time, like, I see mechs, I want to do battling. That's not going to make me win the day necessarily. So I think it's a buy.
I'm cool with that. Yeah, I've cooled dramatically on this game over the years.
You had one of the first copies, right? You backed one of the first copies on that.
I was number two on the campaign.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but I don't dislike the game. But somebody, I played this just the other night. It came out at game night, and I was like, sure, I'll play that. So which of these games then do we bump up to the must buy? Because if we're gonna have an S tier, something's gotta be S tier.
Wormspan?
Good word. Wormspan, yeah. The game that doesn't exist yet. We haven't played.
Yeah. I guess if you have the Burns, I guess we need to have a must buy. Aper, I can't speak to. Between Two Cities, obviously it mechanically and number wise, it does. You could see bumping it up just for that, but I think the rest of it's very flat and simple. I haven't played Rolling Realms, so I can't speak to that. Viticulture, I think, is the general public favorite. I mean, it's always on the top of people's lists, along with Scythe and Wingspan. So I think if you're going to play, if you're going to pick one, and again, I haven't played Apiary, Viticulture, Scythe, and Wingspan could all be contenders for that must-buy category.
Right.
So I would put up those three, and I'm happy to, because I know that all of these are kind of, like, I don't have a strong, like, I think out of the three, I like Scythe the best, and then probably Viticulture, and then Wingspan. But
why don't we do this?
Uh-huh.
And then we'll just bend our own rules a little bit.
What?
Yeah, because we can do whatever we want. Wait, it's our podcast.
We're gonna get emails on this.
Yeah, well, yeah, we are. Anytime we do these tier lists, people are like, "You're wrong. That's a terrible list." I'm like, "Yeah, we did it right." I say we leave Scythe at buy, and we put Rise of Fenris at must buy.
Okay, the expansion.
Yeah, and it'll just be the only expansion we put on here because it's the only one that's a must buy. Tuscany Once Upon a Time was, but now all that stuff comes in Viticulture, so you can't even really. That's not a.
All right.
Whatever.
Yeah, it was a thing back in the day trying to chase all those different pieces down.
Yeah. Alrighty, folks. So here's our tier list. We'll start at the bottom. On the burn side, Anthony's super hot take of Expeditions, which that's going to get us comments. I know it is, because a lot of people like that game. Pendulum. And then we go to Dodge, which is our largest category. But again, there's been some disappointments over the years. Tapestry, Charterstone, Euphoria, Between the Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig, and Red Rising.
Mm-hmm.
Play, we have Libertalia, Winds of Galecrest, and My Little Scythe. Under Buy, we have Apiary, Between Two Cities, Rolling Realms, and Scythe. And then must buy Viticulture, Wingspan, and Scythe, the Rise of Fenris.
Excellent. Yeah, Rise of Fenris, again, I've talked about it a lot. It's their story campaign mode, but it's also two additional factions and new ways to play the game that make the game so much better. It's one of the best expansions that were ever made, and it does so much for Scythe. It's, yeah, 100%. All right, everyone. So there is a Stonemaier game tier list. Please let Anthony know how you feel about it.
Bring it.
At all of our social medias, we always appreciate hearing from everybody out there. Even if you don't agree, that means a lot to us. That lets us know that you're listening out there. BoardGamersAnonymous.com. We have email addresses. Feel free to write us about those things. I'm happy to talk hours and days and weeks about Rise of Fenris. I like it so much. Rate us on any kind of the podcast player you have. It makes a big difference. Regardless of this, a nice review would be helpful. Anyway, until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all a seat at the table. Take care, everyone.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit Hyland.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.